This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Ankur Desai at 16 GMT on Wednesday, the 21st of January. These are our main stories. Donald Trump has told the World Economic Forum he wants immediate negotiations to acquire Greenland for the United States, but he won't take it by force.
People thought I would use force. I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force. All the United States is asking for is a place called Greenland.
We'll have more from Davos, where the US president has been addressing world leaders. Also, the BBC has seen photos of hundreds of victims of the bloody suppression of protests in Iran that was shown to relatives trying to identify the dead. Also coming up in this podcast. The sounds outside court of supporters of a man who assassinated the former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe after being sentenced to life in prison. We also explain a new report from the United Nations, which has declared what it describes as the dawn of an era of global water bankruptcy. And the authorities in the Pakistani city of Lahore have launched a drive to install safety rods on motorbikes to protect riders from potentially deadly kite strings ahead of a festival. We start in the Alpine town of Davos. In normal times, a small and quiet, somewhat picturesque upmarket Swiss ski resort. But these are anything but normal times. It's currently home to the World Economic Forum, a gathering of the global elite who are waiting today to hear from President Trump. It's fair to say European leaders were braced for impact, waiting to hear what the US president would say about plans to impose tariffs on those countries that support Denmark's sovereignty of Greenland. But instead, President Trump, in a wide-ranging speech lasting for around an hour and a half, said he wanted immediate negotiations to acquire Greenland for the United States, although he wouldn't take it by force.
People thought I would use force. I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force. All the United States is asking for is a place called Greenland, where we already had it, as a trustee, but respectfully returned it back to Denmark not long ago after we defeated the Germans, the Japanese, the Italians, and others in World War II. We gave it back to them. We were a powerful force then, but we are a much more powerful force now.
He praised the people and leaders of Denmark, which has sovereignty over the Arctic island, but said only the U.S. could defend it.
We need it for strategic national security and international security. This enormous unsecured island is actually part of North America, on the northern frontier of the Western Hemisphere. That's our territory. It is therefore a core national security interest of the United States of America. And in fact, it's been our policy for hundreds of years to prevent outside threats from entering our hemisphere, and we've done it very successfully. We've never been stronger than we are now.
Mr. Trump said that U.S. ownership of Greenland was a small ask over a piece of ice, and it would be good for NATO, but then went on to attack fellow NATO members for not pulling their weight and mocked the French and Canadian leaders directly. Christian Fraser has been speaking to our Europe correspondent, Nick Beek.
I think undoubtedly there'll be relief that President Trump said he wouldn't use military force to take Greenland, as you say, in itself an extraordinary statement. But of course, it doesn't remove the problem, the fact that he wants it. And I think for many Europeans listening to this, yes, they would have heard him talk about his fondness for Scotland and Germany and his proud European roots. But I think a lot of people would have seen this as a pretty bitter and angry diatribe. And in places, it was just historically inaccurate, as well as being insulting. I mean, the central point for Mr. Trump, he believes that he should be able to get Greenland. And the European point of view, he does not mention, he disregards it, the fact that Europeans say that it's their sovereign territory and it's simply not for sale. Mr. Trump saying that it will actually strengthen the NATO alliance, not destroy it, if he were to take Greenland. And he repeatedly referred to it as being our territory, part of North America, and said absolutely it was not because of the minerals or because of wealth. It was for American security and global security that he was going to get it.
It's the way he speaks to some of his closest allies. It's almost oblivious, Nick, to the fact that they have voting publics, many of these world leaders at home who are listening to some of this. I mean, he talked about Mark Carney. Canada doesn't survive without the US. Remember that, Mark, the next time you make your statements. Or the comments to Emmanuel Macron. He said, there he is yesterday wearing sunglasses when he delivered him this address at Davos. I watched him yesterday. What the hell happened? You know, and there's plenty of comment in the newspapers in France today about the Ray-Bans that Emmanuel Macron was wearing. But he sort of, I don't know, he sort of presses the sore on some of the things that politically are really important for some of these world leaders.
Yeah, and I mean, it's the style and the substance. On the style, he repeatedly says that he likes his allies, either individually or as a nation, deeming them to be great people. But then he says that he does like Emmanuel Macron, although people might find that hard to believe. So there's always some spite there, it would seem, as well as the apparent praise. And I think the Danes in particular will be quite wounded by this, because Mr. Trump went back to the Second World War and talked about the role and the influence of the United States in the victory during the Second World War. And then his position was that the Americans made a big mistake by giving it back, talking about Greenland. But of course, it wasn't the Americans to give back. It's never been part of America. And also for the Danes, you know, there was a huge contribution and sacrifice they made during the Afghanistan campaign. Per population, they suffered hugely in terms of the number of people who were killed there, their servicemen and women. And going to Copenhagen, people really feel that very strongly.
Yeah, just before I let you go, though, there is a kernel of truth, always a kernel of truth, in what Donald Trump says. I mean, with Greenland, there is a security issue which NATO has not looked after. The energy costs in Europe are rising, which is a problem for businesses. Growth is low. It's anemic. He's talked about the mix of energy and how different countries have got it wrong. And of course, he's talked about the issue with migration, which is roiling politics all across Europe. So, European leaders don't like some of the things that Donald Trump says, there will be quite a lot of people out there within the European voting public who will say, well, he does have a point on some of these things.
Yeah, and he dragged the European Union and other allies to this 5% spending target for spending on the militaries, all those countries in NATO. And most people now say that that's a really vital level that they meet if they are going to meet the threats of a rapidly changing world. But I think the way things were presented today, it would be fascinating, Christian, to see what the Europeans do next. They've got this big summit in Brussels tomorrow. Do they take a breath? Do they say, you know, apart from the sound and fury, is Mr. Trump going to go through with this tariff threat on those eight countries, including the UK, France and Germany? Will they kick in on February the 1st, or will he kick it not into the long grass, but will he have a little pause on this? It'd be fascinating to see whether they hit back or they try and take some sort of sting out of this and take a beat.
Nick Beek reporting there, and we'll have more reaction and analysis on the later edition of the Global News podcast. To Iran now, where several thousand people are thought to have been killed by the Iranian security forces in recent anti-government protests. Many relatives have found it difficult to identify their loved ones who have died. Photos leaked to BBC Verify show the faces of hundreds of people killed in the violent crackdown. The images were displayed in a South Tehran mortuary and were one of the few ways to identify the dead. I got more from Merlin Thomas.
I was sent a secret folder of hundreds of photos from this mortuary in South Tehran. And these are victims of people who were killed during the Iranian government's crackdown on protesters. Now, we've blurred these images to show viewers and audiences, but they show really close-up, bloodied, bruised, swollen faces of dead men and women. These are people who were killed in the crackdown. Now, these pictures were used as a way for families to try and identify their loved ones. And we were told that families were huddled around a screen in a mortuary, essentially watching a slideshow of dead bodies for hours. And we've combed through these images and we've identified at least 326 victims, including 18 women. Now, we were told that victims were so disfigured at times that even their loved ones couldn't identify them. And we were also told there were victims there as young as 12 or 13. And we've separately corroborated that by viewing a different video, which we've also verified, in which we see what appears to be the body of a child.
Sounds extremely harrowing and difficult to digest. And you and the BBC Verify team have been tracking the spread of anti-government protests. So how are you going about doing this? But also, The challenge of facing an internet blackout as well, that must cause issues too.
Absolutely. The internet blackout has been almost total for nearly 2 weeks now. And there have been dribs and drabs of information kind of coming out in pockets. And this is one of those pockets of information that have come out. But it shows just how desperate people are to get this sort of information out into the world to show people what is happening to protesters inside Iran, but also what's happening to the families left behind. And they're going to extreme lengths and at great personal risk to themselves to share this information.
And what about a response from the Iranian state? Have you heard anything from them?
The Iranian supreme leader has admitted and publicly acknowledged that thousands have been killed, but he blames the US, Israel, and what he calls seditionists for this.
BBC Verify's Merlin Thomas there. Now, heads up from us. For more depth and analysis on one of our big stories of the day, you can go on YouTube, search for BBC News, and then click on the logo, and then choose podcasts, and then the Global News podcast. There's a new story available every weekday. Sounds you can hear from outside a court in the Japanese city of Nara, where protesters staged a small demonstration in support of Tetsuya Yamagami, the man convicted of the murder of the former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in 2022. Mr. Abe was shot with a homemade gun in Nara City in western Japan while campaigning for his re-election. Our correspondent Shaima Khalil is in Tokyo and is following the story.
The sentencing today was of Tetsuya Yamagami, the man who pled guilty for the assassination of Shinzo Abe. He was in the court and he sat quietly, his hands on his lap, his head down, as his life in prison sentence was being read to him. Outside the district court, we've been watching footage all day, really, of people lining up in the cold, trying to get into the court. There were hundreds outside the court, and there were very limited seats inside the court because they wanted to witness that moment. Because, of course, the assassination of Shinzo Abe shocked Japan. It shocked the world for so many reasons, but it also led to a political fallout. And that very moment where he was going to receive that sentence was going to be a very key moment in a case that has really stunned a country that is not used to political violence on that level, not used to gun violence on that level.
And what did we learn today about Tetsuya Yamagami and his motivation for the murder during this trial?
Well, throughout the trial, Tetsuya Yamagami was talking about his motive, talking about the hardships that he faced mentally and growing up within his family. And this is because his mother was a devout follower to the controversial Unification Church, and she'd made immense amounts of donations that he said had left his family bankrupt. And throughout the last few months, as he took to the stand and spoke to the judges, he spoke about how this affected him mentally, how the hardships that he faced growing up. There was a standout moment when he was speaking and the judge was asking him how old he was, or to confirm that he was 45 years old. And he was silent and he said, "I did not expect to live that long." And it just gave you an idea about his mental state at that moment. We also learned that he decided to kill Shinzo Abe because of what he learned about his links to the Unification Church, his close links to the controversial church. And so on the 8th of July in 2022, as Shinzo Abe was giving a political speech in broad daylight in support of a local candidate in Nara district, Yamagami walked up to him and shot him at close range using a homemade gun. And again, that was quite shocking and it stunned Japan, of course, because of who Shinzo Abe was. He was the former prime minister, but he was still the longest serving prime minister, a very influential figure, but also because gun violence in Japan is so rare. And so the combination of those two things, the fact that Shinzo Abe was taken to hospital and then pronounced dead soon after, really stunned the nation, but it then started an investigation into the motives and into the Unification Church.
Shama Khalil reporting from Tokyo. Still to come on this podcast, OpenAI rolls out age prediction on ChatGPT for under-18s. But when it comes to guessing your age, will it get it right? A new report from the United Nations has declared what it describes as the dawn of an era of global water bankruptcy. The report defines this as a situation when long-term water use and pollution have exceeded renewable inflows of water and key parts of the water system can no longer be brought back to previous supply levels. The study's lead author is Kaveh Madani, director of the UN University's Institute for Water, Environment and Health, also known as the UN's think tank on water. He's been speaking to Ansoy.
By looking at the trends of changes in water storage, we've concluded that we are seeing more and more basins around the world that are showing symptoms of significant overconsumption and in many cases also irreversibility of the damages to the ecosystem. So when we say the globe is water bankrupt, the planet is water bankrupt, we don't mean that the whole world or every country, every basin, every aquifer is water bankrupt. But we mean that this is an era where we are seeing more and more systems getting into the post-crisis situation. Water pollution problems are becoming chronic. They're no longer anomaly or deviation from a normal, and these are permanent problems. But we should worry about them because in an interconnected world where we are interconnected not only through the climate system, but also through trades, food trades, trades of different goods and supply chains, in addition to economics, geopolitics, migration, and other issues, the whole global risk landscape has been impacted, and this can have major consequences for the world.
What are the biggest factors behind this global water bankruptcy?
On one side, we have climate change that is resulting in declining water levels in many other places. But at the same time, on the other hand, we have increased water consumption because of course, increased population, but the demand, increased demand for food, energy, drinking water, industrialization, now data centers on top of all these things. So we continue to consume more and more. We continue to grow more food. And we continue to expand. On the other hand, we are facing declining water resources. So this has worked in a way that, like, you know, that we took more and more water out of the system. We withdrew more water first from our checking account. That surface water, the water that gets renewed through precipitation every year. Then we went to our savings account, our groundwater. We drained that one. Now we have a lot of stakeholders out there. We took more and more loans from the nature. We kind of stole even the share of the environment, the silent stakeholder. And as a result, we are now seeing that there are major ecosystem damages. Our wetlands are dry. Our reservoirs are declining. Water level is dropping. And we see a lot of symptoms, sinkholes around the world, land subsidence in different parts of the world, desertification, sand and dust storms, world wildfires, and all different manifestations of water bankruptcy. One thing that the report also tells us is that it's not only about quantity. Water bankruptcy is also about quality. In certain parts of the world, we have water on paper. Water is available in terms of is so bad that it cannot be used properly.
Kaveh Madani speaking to Ansoy. Phrases like district-wide crackdown and non-bailable offence aren't usually ones you'd associate with flying a kite. But for nearly 20 years, authorities in parts of India and Pakistan have been putting in tough measures to try and regulate kite flying after a series of deaths. Now, ahead of the spring festival Basant in Pakistan, authorities in the city of Lahore have launched a new safety campaign. Our global affairs correspondent Ambaras Nethirajan was an enthusiastic kite flyer as a child. He told me more.
This used to be a very popular sport before the advent of these you know, smartphones when people really spent time out in the open.
People actually had a life, yeah.
People had a life, yeah. So people usually fly kites, and they became more advanced with the technology, with a lot of colorful kites, with the big strings and the rolls which carry the strings.
And it's very competitive as well.
And also very competitive. You know, when we used to do that, we used to try to cut down the neighbor's kites or your friend's kites. That used to be a competition. Now, this has got another dimension to it. To make the string stronger, then people, especially, you know, in Pakistan and in India, they will coat the string with the glass-coated strings or metal strings. Sometimes when these cut strings, when they go fly across the roads, they will catch the unsuspecting motorcyclists, especially, you know, people going on the motorcyclists because they're going at a speed, and then the strings come and go around their neck and then cause injury, sometimes even death. And that's why the authorities banned this sport. In fact, one senior Pakistani minister called it as a blood sport.
Wow.
So they banned it 20 years ago. And then despite the ban, people used to do this because you can't send police to every nook and corner of, you know, a massive city like Lahore. People used to fly kites. So that was, the ban was lifted late last year. But then the government also put in a lot of safety measures. And
yeah,
rules.
What are they? What are some of these new
like one of measures? Them is like having a, you know, a rod, like an arch from from the front of the bike up to the back so that the strings do not come directly and hit the motorbikers. And also the sellers will have to register themselves. There'll be a QR code, so it will link you back to the seller's identity. The selling will be only from the first of February for a week, because the festival is from 6th and 7th, 8th of Feb. And children under the age of 18, they are not allowed to fly kites. And if you have any metal-coated strings, then you will face a prison term. And also, the authorities are encouraging educational institutions to provide their buses so that people can use buses that time rather than using two-wheelers or motorbikes so that they can be safe. So these are some of the measures they are introducing. But it is a very popular festival, the springtime and the arrival of spring. So people are looking forward to it because the ban has been lifted after a period of 20 years.
Ambarasan Ethirajan. Now, whether it's creating violent and gory content or depicting self-harm, there are things most parents would probably agree they don't want their children using AI for. But stopping it happening is proving to be a big problem for the likes of ChatGPT. The chatbot's creators have started rolling out their latest tool to try and solve it. The newsroom's Will Chalk follows AI stories for us and has been looking over this one.
I mean, if people don't use ChatGPT, I think it can be quite easy to kind of shrug these stories off. But the app says it's approaching around 1 billion users. And to take just one bit of research out of the US, 86% of the school students that a charity spoke to said they're using AI. So clearly this is the thing that particularly younger people are integrating into their everyday lives. But as you said, keeping it safe for under 18s hasn't always been easy. And perhaps kind of the biggest, most explosive, shocking case is the lawsuits that ChatGPT are facing, alleging that it encouraged people, including teenagers, to take their own lives. Now, OpenAI, ChatGPT's creator, denies this, and these cases are still going through the courts as well. The company has also repeatedly spoken about the lengths it goes to keep young people safe. And that brings us to today. So OpenAI, ChatGPT's creators, have started rolling out this new age verification tool. So historically and at the moment, users provide their age. You just simply tell it. You tell it how old you are. It believes you and then you can use it.
Yeah.
Now, ChatGPT says it's going to start monitoring users and seeing if it can use other clues. So either things to do with your account or how you're using it to work out your age. And if it suspects that you are then under 18, it will put extra safeguards in place. And if you are actually an adult and you're told you're under 18 because of how you're using it, you can then use a selfie or some ID to prove your age and get your account back.
Okay, then with something that thinks like AI, how easy is it then to restrict?
Well, this is the endless battle that ChatGPT faces between freedom of expression and safety. So you listed a couple of them before, but the things that ChatGPT says it will restrict if it thinks you're under 18 are graphic violence, viral challenges that could encourage risky behaviour, sexual, romantic or violent role play, depictions of self-harm and content that promotes things like body shaming. Now, these are things that some people would say it's not healthy for anyone to be engaging with AI about, but that's maybe slightly short-sighted because people are using AI for nuanced things, to write fiction, you know. And if you put too many restrictions in, it can start misinterpreting perfectly innocent requests, you know, write a chapter about a fight or something, as you doing violent content and therefore blocking it. So this is the battle ChatGPT has to strike, right? On one hand, freedom of expression, let people use their tool as freely as possible. On the other hand, stopping it feeding dangerous information to vulnerable people. They would say they're already doing this. They would say this tool is further evidence of that. But I think it needs to be rolled out for a bit before we can see how well it actually works.
The newsroom's Will Chalk reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this episode or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on X at BBC World Service, and you can use the hashtag Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jonathan Greer, and the producer was Charles Sanctuary. The editor is Karen Martin, and I'm Ankur Desai. Until next time, goodbye.